People go into a room and then some purple smoke flies up and suddenly you have your game on Steam.
This is Up Up Down Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Maya Kramer. Maya is an indie PR and production expert. Maya relentlessly tours conferences, expos, and Indiecades, getting the word out about great indie games. Hi, Maya.
Hey there.
How's it going?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. Mm-hmm. So we're recording here actually in the morning, maybe a record earliest show, 10 a.m., but we're excited to be talking about PR and marketing in games, which is something that I have little practical experience with, specifically in games, but I find really interesting, especially as the explosion in the number of games that are available out there is kind of getting, I don't want to say out of control. It's a good thing that there's so many good games out there, but it becomes more and more important for people who are making games and thinking about games to sort of understand how do people find out about them? How do people actually get the word out about games?
Yeah, definitely.
So how do people get the word out?
Well, like you said, it's becoming sort of more and more important. I don't know if it's becoming technically harder. You're doing all the same things as you would have been doing a few years ago, but the problem is that everybody else is as well. So the market's not saturated by any means, but definitely a lot louder than it used to be. Basically, for an indie, we don't sort of have the same options and same budgets as AAAs. So there's less of these, TV spots and giant, massive booths at conferences. There's much more of a smaller grassroots movement type of, strategy. I think a lot of indie developers are seeing how important it is to either go to shows or do things like podcasts and get in touch with other people in the industry to be able to talk about their game.
Yeah, it's definitely, I've found it very cool how enthusiastic folks in the indie game scene are to come on the show or things like that. Getting someone who's worked on a AAA game to talk on the podcast, I'll meet someone at a conference or something like that, and I'll be like, oh, you worked on Last of Us? Oh, that's really cool. You should come on the podcast. And you can see the fear in their eyes, like, oh, I'm probably not supposed to do that.
I think AAA has a lot less flexibility in what they can do. They're answering to, a ton of people above them as well, right? It's not just them and what they want to do. They have to think about the whole company and paperwork they've signed and all sorts of things. So
you get very stern lectures when you're working for a AAA game company about not talking to the press without without previous say so from PR. It's they take that stuff very seriously.
We're not press, we're just people who record things and post them on the internet that
for
seem
the public.
Official.
For the public.
Definitely that's something that's been fun to see. So you've been doing a lot of booths and expos over the last year at least.
So yeah, the past year has sort of been as many shows as I can do with as many games as I can bring, for those games to make sure that they get seen. And visibility is a tough thing to sort of gauge whether you've gained it or not. There's no like metric you can set and sort of like, oh, I have visibility now. It's a lot more subtle than that. I thought, okay, I've got a year. I can sort of support myself throughout most of this. I'm going to try and go pro bono to like as many shows as I possibly can with as many games. And it's been exhausting, I'm not going to lie, but it's been pretty enlightening. Different shows bring you different things, and there's so many different ways to go to shows. There's a lot of different tiers of money you can spend at shows. everything from very, very low to many dollars. So, I think this past year has been, it's been eye-opening at the very least.
So you're going pro bono, is that each time you go to a show, you pick a game or arrange a game to be promoting? Or do you have like the Maya booth where you're promoting like, here's the 10 games that I think are really cool and you should check them out? Or
I feel like that would be my ideal, but no, I'm not doing that. I'm definitely sort of teaming up with developers one by one and helping them bring games to shows. And usually I pick sort of at a show, it's really tough to do more than one. It really is. Sure. If you're on your own. But it's a lot easier for me to sort of work with a developer before the show and set them up with expectations of what the show will be, what their goals are for the show, and then help them while they're there. So it's really awesome not being on your own at a show, I think is the bottom line here. If you're a developer going, it's important to have a support network with you. And if that means someone actually working the booth with you, or just someone you can call at some point and say, you know, this happened, what do I do? Or should I do this, you know, should I do this interview or should I not? Because it's a lot to think about when you're showing your own game and have, you know, probably ship stress, as I call it. You know, you're either pre or post shipping and you're freaking out about that. It's great to have sort of just someone to bounce ideas off of.
Even having a second person at the booth, like I've done some expos before, and just being the only person at the booth. And for one hand, I think people feel a little more comfortable coming up if there's like sort of two people rather than the one person who looks maybe potentially lonely. and then also you can like do crazy things like go to the washroom and the booth isn't unmanned and things like that. So it's a nice luxury to be able to have someone to help you, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, have something that can sub in.
It's also kind of depressing. Like, I've never manned a booth from a publicity standpoint, but I did man Radical's booth one or two years at GDC for like collecting resumes and stuff like that. And just being in a booth by yourself, like it seems way more depressing how infrequently people come up to it if you don't have someone else to talk to.
It's actually so hard. That's such a good point, because it's so hard to keep your own energy high enough to yes. want to even make eye contact with someone or strike up conversation with another person. Let's say they do come by the booth, right, and you are the only person. If you're tired and you haven't eaten, it's almost impossible to ensure that that person gets what they were looking for from the booth, right? So even having another human being there just to sort of keep the energy levels at a, I don't know, a steady level, something better than exhausted, is so, so, so important. It's invaluable for sure.
Yeah. How much do you find that the sort of expectations are, I mean, expectations matter less and more like the sort of the optimal thing that you should be doing as far as like booth setup and what you should be talking about and what you should be bringing to a show differs from show to show, depending on kind of what the audience is. Like GDC is, you know, mostly like game developers and journalists, from my understanding, as opposed to something like PAX, where it's like fans everywhere as far as the eyes can see.
Yeah. It's funny. A lot of people, I've spoken to a lot of teams about this, and a lot of people sort of ask me, is it worth going to GDC if I'm not going to be showing my game, mostly if it's an unreleased game. If I'm not going to be showing my unreleased game to people who would buy it, is it worth me spending the money to go? And I always stress the point that it's so important to go to conferences, both where there are fans and consumers and where there are other developers. Because to talk to other developers and you get to know people within your community who are also creating is super crucial. It's super, super crucial. The more that your name and your sort of, I guess, you know, brand, if you want to call it that, is out there, the more that you're able to say, oh, hey, I saw you at the last conference and yeah, we spoke last time and this time we can talk about new things. What are you working on? That's still visibility. I know it doesn't feel like visibility. I know it doesn't feel like, because it doesn't translate straight to sales right away. But it's the special type of visibility that means that you're involved in your community. And there's almost, I think, really, for indies especially, being involved in the community is as important, if not, I think, almost at a certain stage, more important than making sure you have an ad out for your game or that you know, like, I don't know. Yeah.
No, totally. That makes a lot of sense. That's something we've learned. So I've been indie, although my sort of day job is more on the app side, but for coming up on 5 years now. And in the early days, it's like, okay, we got to get as many people to know about us as possible directly. And so that's, you know, focused on like, okay, how many Twitter followers can SteamConk get? How many people can we get in our mailing list? How many, like, let's run ads and put stuff about our products in front of people. And that just had mixed, amounts of success, ranging from mild success to zero success. Like, ads are very expensive per install. Like, for a game that's $20, you can run an ad, you can make a sale for $20, depending, you know, if it's a good game. But if it's like a $2 mobile game, then you're going to have a really hard time making a sale for $2. So I was kind of frustrated by that and got a little cynical about the whole PR and marketing thing. And then started doing, like you say, focusing more on getting sort of involved in the community and meeting people who are other developers, people who are in sort of the journalism side, which sounds like, oh, am I going to meet the sort of reviewer who might review my game from New York Times? Well, maybe, but, you know, just meeting somebody who has like a small website that I haven't heard of, but they write really insightful things about my industry, about games or about apps or whatever, is super useful. And then that kind of snowballs. And so we've gotten to the point now from doing that, that now when we announce a new product or we announce something we're working on, it gets multiplied, if it's good, it gets multiplied through that network of people in the community. And then also before we even announce it, I can sort of pre-flight it. Like there was something that we were working on for a few months that I was able to get a whole bunch of input in for us to learn that we probably shouldn't do it before we even embarrass ourselves of like announcing it.
That's priceless. That right there, what you said, is really, really important. That level of feedback from other people who have been through what you're about to go through, and they can say it's wisdom, right? It's community wisdom, and tapping into that is super, super important.
That kind of networking can also translate into direct sales through, you know, getting a piece of other people's audience, right? Like the people who are listening to another developer because they're fans of that work. If you're, you know, if you're friends with the developers that are doing the same kind of work that you are, then they're going to mention that at some point, and they're, you know, their fans are going to say, oh, here's someone else that I should look into because they're doing the same kind of thing that this other guy that I like is doing. Or you can get in situations where you end up doing stuff collaboratively. I mean, a lot of the indie game developers that we've talked to have talked about how people tend to kind of jump around between projects and collaborate on stuff because there's certain, particularly because there's certain specialty areas like music that, you know, lots of people aren't able to do, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to make a living doing your own indie games if you're primarily a sound or music guy. But if you jump around and collaborate with a bunch of people on a bunch of different things, then, you know, then your name gets out there as a guy who does cool music for games. And, you know, that also can translate into borrowing a bit of someone else's audience if you're collaborating on their projects or they're collaborating on your projects.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I would caution people, and this is a line that a lot of people have trouble with. The difference between exactly what you just said, which is sort of being involved in the community, getting to know people, and then letting that organically sort of translate into collaboration or, you know, audience sharing, and badgering a developer because you really want them to retweet this tweet you made. And I know that to a lot of people, it's really hard to know what it is to sort of, like, social groups are stressful, you know, and a lot of us in the game development industry are introverted and sort of shy and don't understand or really want to exert this it's a lot of effort and a lot of energy. And a lot of us just don't have it, you know, flat out just don't have it to sort of make friends with tons and tons of people. Not everybody, I always make the joke, like, not everybody is Rami Ismail, right? Like, not everybody's able to travel to literally everything and be friends with every single person and remember every single name and face. He's so good at doing that. And so it becomes this daunting task to make friends in an industry where, and on top of that, a lot of us, if not all of us, have imposter syndrome forever, you know, just forever. We all think, like, this is such an amazing industry and these people are so great. I don't belong here. You know, and that comes up all the time when I'm working with developers. And I always have to say, you know, the good thing is we all feel it, and if you let this happen at its own pace and you talk to people and you genuinely build connections with people, it will benefit you in ways that you can't see right now. And those ways are exactly what you said. It is collaboration. It is audience sharing. But it can't be forced. It really can't be forced.
That imposter syndrome gets even worse as you sort of meet the people that you really look up to or whatever, that you really would love some sort of feedback from, and then this part of your brain is like, oh my God, I can't be talking to John Carmack. That's obviously impossible. He just doesn't know how stupid I am. Yeah. So then you get even more nervous and embarrass yourself even worse. And
yeah, and that's okay too. To that whole nervousness and embarrassing yourself is part of the process. And everybody I've met, I mean, that was me not even a year ago still. You know, like I've been trying to do this sort of without that imposter syndrome for a long time now. And even this year, I had multiple moments where I made a complete fool of myself because I just couldn't speak. You know, I met the guys from Cappy and I just couldn't speak. My voice wasn't working, you know, and I said something stupid, and forever I think of it in my head. And you talk to them a year later and they're like, we don't even remember what you're talking about. You know, like, we're in the games industry. Everybody's a weirdo. So don't worry. If you mess up, it's really not a big deal.
I had a guy in the Vancouver community that I had been like heard about secondhand and wanted to meet. And then like three times in a row over the span of years, I would meet him and then say something kind of dumb. And then he would be like, and he also wouldn't remember me, and he would remember my name wrong and stuff like that. And so I, in my mind, he had this long-term memory of this dumb Alan guy who was always saying awkward things or whatever, but they were never really like interestingly awkward. It just wasn't the thing I was trying to, or I wanted to say. And then so on like the fourth time, I just like kind of like politely ignored him in a group situation. Then after a while, somebody was like, oh, yeah, have you met Alan? He's like, oh, no, nice to meet you. And then went from there, and it was totally fine. He didn't remember. But for, in a good way, right? Like, he wasn't dwelling on, like, man, that one sentence was slightly misformed 3 years ago when I met this guy at a conference or something. It always, doesn't work like that.
Yeah, it always feels way worse to us than it does to anybody we're meeting. Like, it's really not that big a deal.
So we're going around the world, and especially North America, visiting all these expos and things like that. And this seems like it's becoming, it seems like it's becoming more important for people to be, you know, promoting indie games especially, but games in general at expos and shows and stuff like that, which is interesting because in other industries, like, for example, in the Apple world, there used to be, you know, Apple Expos on like twice a year, one on each coast where everyone was showing off all the stuff they were working on. And they still have some, like, they definitely have conferences where there's like talks about how do you develop software, but much less stuff where it's like sort of here's what we've made, marketing booths and all that kind of stuff. Why is the game industry so, like, why does game industry benefit from sort of the show culture and booths and expos and stuff more than other industries?
I don't know that it's necessarily true that those things don't happen in other industries. I was looking up, some examples of, like, stuff from other industries, and you compare, for example, E3, right, the big gaming trade convention, had an attendance last year of about 50,000 people, whereas the Frankfurt Book Fair, which is like the equivalent thing in the book industry, had an attendance of almost 300,000. I think the thing that's different about games is that people who aren't in the industry care about the gaming trade shows a lot more than in other industries. Like, that those kinds of trade shows exist in all industries and are really important to the people in the industries and serve a really important purpose. But in a lot of other industries, they're not something that the public is really on. It's not on their radar, right? Like, I always pay attention to, like, E3 or Tokyo Game Show or GDC, and I'm watching the trailers and stuff like that. I will bet you that my wife, who's as big a fan of books as I am of video games, has never pays any attention to the Frankfurt Book Fair. You know, she doesn't know when it's going on or like what exciting titles have been announced at the Frankfurt Book Fair, and isn't reading like excerpts of books, you know, that were shown at the Frankfurt Book Fair. But for people in the industry, it's like huge, as big, if not bigger, a deal than E3 is. So I think mainly what's going on is that in video games you have this like strongly enthusiast press, and you know, these really passionate viewers that are clinging to all these little bits of information and pulling them out because they're interested in them as the general public. And that's what's unique about the games industry compared to other industries that have trade shows.
Yeah, and I think that we're made of bells and whistles. I mean, the point of a video game is that it's flashy and pretty to look at, and you can put it on a really big screen and with, you know, loud music, and that just means that it shows better, let's say, on the internet than a book fair does, right? You've got this massive book fair, but do you take pictures of the books? You know, like, what do you show online, or what do you live stream? I think you can definitely live stream live readings, you know, but for video games, it's built for the mediums that we're all, you know, willing to look at, and sort of that everybody who is interested in any sort of media, like, will be exposed to, right? So news and TV and internet.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like, obviously, compared to, I can't even really think of something that would show better in that context of, like, here's a cool new thing to look at than sort of games. I guess, like, maybe if there was, like, a 3D visualization conference. But then, look, it's like SIGGRAPH, that's, you know, pretty well.
Yep.
It, you know, people pay attention to that, and it's, like, sort of computer graphics research and stuff like that.
Maybe,
and, like,
comics?
Yeah.
Maybe San Diego
Comic-Con. Comic-Con.
And I feel like Comic-Con definitely. Comic-Con has sort of gone from just comics. I don't even actually, I have no idea if it was ever just comics. I'll be really honest. But I do know that they've incorporated all this TV stuff and these, like, cartoons and all this other stuff, and they've got these live panels and that kind of thing. And that is the same thing as what we do, right? It's the same thing as video games. You've got something to show. You've got a video, you've got images, and you've got people who are able to speak in the moment and interact with an audience who are their fan base.
Film festivals are kind of the same thing in the film world.
Definitely.
And they're in a similar way, there'll be, like, journalists that are pre-hyping it, like, oh, these are the films that we're excited to see at this film festival, and then rapping afterward, here are the films that we were glad to see at the film festival and things like that, which raises the awareness of sort of quote-unquote normal people. And therefore, like, you know, there'll be people specifically looking at what was announced at PAX, what was announced at this event, and therefore, it sort of is this virtuous cycle then where it's beneficial to, you know, hurry up and have something to demo for that show because people are expecting. Although, I guess with film, it's not as much of a demo. Hopefully, it's in pretty good shape when you show it. But
though there is substantial editing that goes on films after they've been on the festival circuit in some cases. Like, it's definitely not, you know, the sort of movies that are the huge blockbusters, no one sees them until they're kind of ready to go, and they don't usually show at film festivals and stuff like that. But your smaller indie movies, the kind that will get shown at film festivals, like, sometimes they will show them and have a not successful showing at a film festival and go back and substantially re-edit the movie for going out on the festival circuit again or for the final release.
Yeah, you know, and your question sort of leads me to wonder if there's this, I know it exists, I've encountered it before, there's sort of this perception that in video games, shows translate directly to how well you're doing as a game. So if you go to you have to go to a show to do really well, or you go to a show, the converse sort of is like you go to the show and therefore you do really well, right? It's sort of this like unfortunate almost myth that a lot of developers, and we're also talking, you know, we've approached the subject of AAA, like, you know, big film and big games versus indies and how important it is to those two things and whether there's a difference there, and there is, right? But I think with a film festival, like, I have to wonder, I have no idea, how imperative is it that they go to this show as an independent film creator and show their film, and what is the process to do that, and how much, you know, chance, how, I don't know, how high are their chances for even getting into something like that versus video games, where your chances are actually much higher, I think, than a lot of other places where you've got, you know, you don't have to make, you know, the biggest game. You just have to make a game and submit it to, you know, a panel of people such as, you know, Indie Mega Booth, and they have to like it enough to say, sure, you can have this small space in this small show. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it's actually something that compares to any other industry or not.
I think film festivals are, they definitely allow indies and film to do something different than what indies can do in video games, is kind of jump the tracks, right? That if a, because, you know, you can go and make a movie for a tremendously small budget that can compete in terms of quality with big films. Like, that's sort of part of the nature of film, is that, you know, making, I mean, setting aside the, like, action tentpole kind of movies, like, you can make a movie for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars that competes well on quality with one that cost millions of dollars, because, you know, you can find unknown actors that happen to be as good as name actors that can open a movie but just aren't known yet. And so what a film festival can let an indie filmmaker do is have someone see their movie and be like, wow, this is amazing. We got to give this a real release, right? And indie films will get picked up, or films that don't have a distributor at all will get picked up by big name distributors as a result of being shown at film festivals. And that's something that I don't think the equivalent operation in the games industry really exists. Like, you can't, you can't, you're not going to be like, okay, I'm making this little like quirky platformer game with a couple of friends of mine. And then someone from like Activision sees it and is like, hey, I want to publish that game. Like, that doesn't,
you wouldn't want that deal anyway.
You know, the games industry doesn't work that way. Whereas the film industry can work that way. Like, you could definitely,
Yeah, like the games industry is sort of trying to head in that direction, because there's all sorts of smaller indie publishers now, right? You've got like everything from Atlus to Devolver, and, you know, even Double Fine in a way attempting to pick up these games and help them out. But I don't know. I think you're right. I think that it's nowhere near that level yet, which is, it's interesting. It's an interesting sort of place for the games market to be.
I was talking to someone at Full Indie who was like very new to the games industry, and he had been working on a game for a couple of years, and he said it's almost ready. And he asked me for my advice, and he's like, how do you think I would find a publisher? And like, this is like a sort of little indie game, like it was one person built on the side. And I'm like, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that you do not want a publisher. You want to, you know, you want to put your game out into the world and, you know, do as best as you can to market it, or maybe find somebody like Maya who, you know, understands how to do that marketing stuff. But I don't think that there's a lot of business going on right now of someone completely breaking out into the industry by just like calling up publishers with for their totally indie game. I don't know. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, definitely accurate. I see Devolver doing a lot of interesting stuff when it comes to games where they may not have been heard of before and you're kind of new. You know, I mean, the guys that did Broforce really made a great game, and Devolver helped them out quite a bit. And then you've got, you know, Devolver approaching Hotline Miami to say like, hey, you want to do Hotline Miami 2 with us? And it's just like perfect marriage of, you know, a publisher that's already known and a game that's already really known. And then it gives everybody a boost. Everybody now under Devolver has a boost because you're like, oh, I know Devolver and I know Hotline Miami and they're working together. So I sort of, even I have this tendency to sort of trust what they're doing if I like a game that they already have. But yeah, for a person just starting out, it doesn't make much sense to right now, especially go with a publisher, just because you're probably not going to make, probably not going to make, I say that with emphasis, millions of dollars off your first game. I know people who have, right? I'm not going to say it's impossible, but you're probably not going to make a huge amount of money off that first game. And so it doesn't make sense to sort of take a bunch of money from a publisher and bank on you being able to pay them back or whatever deal you strike with them. Because a lot of people forget that it's not just free money. It's not like, you know, someone's walking up to you and saying like, well, here's $10,000 for this week and we'll publish your game and then we'll never have to talk ever again. You know, like you don't, there are all sorts of different things you have to go through with them and deals you have to strike, and which is great for, it depends on the team, right? It depends on what you're doing. But yeah, I don't really know. I don't think there's much right now of people who have never made a game before jumping into the publisher world and sort of not regretting it.
There's also a danger that with that. Like, that's something that I've read several things from, like, you know, bottom of the mid-list kind of authors that you can sort of get into this death spiral with taking money from a publisher, because if they don't make back their money, then they're not going to be interested in working with you again. Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. you can have a product that could have been sort of successful on its own terms, in that the people that you wanted to read it, play it, you know, whatever medium it's in, do. But once you've taken the money from the publisher, now you've got a minimum bar of anything below them making back their money is now unsuccessful, right? Whereas when it's just your time that's gone into it, there kind of isn't any lower bar of success, right? If you're doing it as a hobby, you know, and not expecting to make back any money anyways, then every single sale you get is, you know, is money that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't done it. But yeah, you lock yourself into, once you've taken advance, you lock yourself into having to sell that many copies, or now you're kind of dangerous, right? Because you're someone who can't move the amount of money that you were paid to to move with your product, right? And so it's going to make people less willing to take that chance the second time, or lower those numbers. And you can get into the situation where it's like continually would have to take lower and lower advances as things sell less and less. And like I said, I don't think that particular phenomenon happens in games quite the same way, but it's definitely something that's an issue in publishing, that that's a way for authors to kind of go out of business, is get into a death spiral of having to take lower and lower advances from the publisher because their books are selling less and less, publishers are less and less interested in promoting them, and it gets to the point where it's just not profitable to sell their books anymore, even if, you know, a few thousand or a few tens of thousands of people would be interested in reading it. It's not, you know, it's not worth it for the publisher anymore.
Yeah, I think you sort of nailed it right there, where it's like, is it worth it for the publisher or not? And gauging that is so difficult in the games industry, where everything's changing constantly, and we're at this really weird, you know, flux time of indie emerging as a much bigger thing as it was 5 years ago, and it's really hard to tell. But I wouldn't say I'm not trying to tell people to not go with publishers, and I'm not trying to say that publishers are bad. I just want everybody to educate themselves really extensively, talk to other people who have been with publishers, especially the publisher you're looking at, you know, that kind of thing, and talk to the publisher themselves. The other thing is, in indie especially, we're all sort of just, you know, people hanging out. It's really not that big a deal. It's not that hard to sort of fire an email and say, hey, I'm interested in this. Can you send me, you know, some information? And that's, you know, to anybody who, you know, has been with the publisher, or even the publisher themselves. So yeah, it's really important to just know what you're getting into at the end of the day.
I think something that's really mysterious to people in anything, you know, film or TV or games or any of those creative endeavors, of it's this kind of very mysterious thing. How do you go from someone who's not somebody who's, you know, publishing games and successful and known to somebody who is? And there's this kind of like mysterious fog in between mm-hmm. those. And so people think of publisher as like, oh, okay, it must be like music, where, you know, you do some demos and then you play some shows and then someone hears you and they're like, you're going to be big, here's a deal. And then they give you some money so that you can be famous and they promote you. And at least in, you know, the modern days, you know, there's maybe that occasionally happened in AAA games, like in the 90s. Even then, that's a pretty hard path to walk. And it's a hard path to walk in music. But nowadays, that seems to be a pretty uncommon path compared to the sort of build of something, a very small game, like a game jam game or a bunch of game jam games or something like that, to like slowly roll your way up to, you know, larger and larger things, and the people who liked your previous stuff then will sort of promote your future stuff, and then eventually gets to the point where, you know, some journalists know about you, and some, you know, you meet other people in the industry, and it seems to be a more iterative process rather than the sort of first one knocks it out of the park. You know, people have this sort of imagination of, you know, how do I make my first game the $1 million seller? And the answer is sometimes like, okay, well, maybe that's, you know, let's do one step at a time. Let's make your first game pretty good. Let's start with that.
Yeah. I've said this in so many scenarios, and I almost hate saying it because it sounds depressing when I say it, but it's the like very, if you cling to this reality and strive for it, then you'll, you know, have that linear iterative climb like you just said. And that's that don't make games to get rich. Make games to make enough money so that you can make your next game, right? Yeah. Like, make a game and hope to maybe get just enough money out of it that you can maybe start development on your next game, and for like 2 months focus on that, just that game. You know, like, it's not going to be years, it's not going to be forever that you can, you know, not worry about money. But maybe a couple, if you just make enough to get by for 2 months, then you're like, oh, I've won. This is it. That's the definition of success in indie games, is that you can focus on your next project for a short period of time. But we all see these huge outliers, those like points on the graph that are these anomalies, right? We see the $1 million games and the people who suddenly are famous, and, you know, the Phil Fishes and John Blows and Notches of the industry. And you kind of, that's not reality.
Well, Notch just outbid Jay-Z on a mansion in L.A., so my indie game's got to make at least $1 million.
Exactly.
And there's always that risk in any one of those, you know, like, oh, this person was an overnight success thing, is almost all of the overnight successes, when you look at them closer, are like, yeah, they were an overnight success. It only took them 10 years to make the thing that made them an overnight success, right?
Exactly.
That everyone loves that, like, you know, kid comes into the big city from the sticks and hits it big kind of story, such that they'll make that the story, even if it's really, no, this guy was like toiling in the mines for, for 10 years and then finally managed to.
Yeah. That's something I've noticed, actually. I'll see sometimes somebody whose work I've been following, and then at once they sort of get more mainstream success than their sort of like previous games, and like some of the really older bad ones start going away off that list, and it's only like, oh wow, his first game was that pretty good one? That's impressive. It's like, well.
Yeah, that's almost never the case. You just update your resume, right? Things drop off the bottom, so. Yeah, let's look at this.
So in that sort of topic of getting started from zero, how much luck do you think, like, how much do you think luck is a factor when somebody's, like, they've done their sort of first, you know, maybe first kind of substantial game that's not just like a little game jam or a demo or something like that, and let's assume it's good, or at least it's pretty good. How much is luck a factor in order to actually get it noticed and, you know, start getting things? And we haven't talked too much about what goals might be for someone other than to just get sales, which is obviously, that's great. But there's also other goals someone might have, like maybe they want to, you know, get on Steam. Maybe they want to get some contacts at Sony so they could port it to the PS4 or things like that. Maybe they want to get a write-up in Polygon or something like that. How much of that is, you know, just think kind of like the sheer luck that someone happens, you know, someone who is a good contact to have happens to find the game in the right place? And how much do you think the system is efficient at like rising up good stuff so that it gets found? Because like, I feel like the system's pretty efficient because I'm finding good games all the time. But every once in a while, I'll come across some game that's like totally obscure, that's on the bottom of, especially on iOS, is really bad. There'll be this game like on the obscurely I found in search, and like, as far as I can tell, no one downloads it, but it's really good, but no one actually knew it was there.
The system is not efficient. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like it is. It's definitely working for some, and those are the games that you end up seeing. It's also it's growing. It's sort of finding its feet still. Like, there's no system out there right now that's efficient in any way. But that's all because they're all too young still, I think. And I mean, and other things like how Steam is this magical, bizarre place that's kind of like choosing the Pope, where you go, people go into a room and then some purple smoke flies up and suddenly you have your game on Steam, right? It's like, okay, I don't really understand what just happened. But, you know, it's so hard in an industry where it would not be fair to call it all sort of gatekeeping or curation, but it really is. It's really hard to develop a system where it self-curates or where people curate it. I mean, you know, Steam, I guess, tried to do that with Greenlight or whatever you want to say they were trying to do with that bizarre beast of a project. But, I mean, it's so hard to know what's luck. In retrospect, it's always going to make more sense. You can look back in your life and say, oh, I can see what I did here to meet this person there, and it all is laid out. But in the moment, it's going to feel like luck, and especially from observer's point of view, it's going to look like luck. And I think that luck really is more this willingness to be flexible in the moment, to sort of have the foresight to say like, oh, I know that this person, this, like, you know, Sony's guys, you know, I know that Nick Suttner is a totally nice dude and that there's a party tomorrow night after Full Indie and I've heard he's going to be there. And you just sort of show up to it and then strike a conversation with someone next to him. And then, you know, it looks and feels like luck, but you need to have your finger on the pulse of what it is that you need right now and what your game needs right now. And then try to draw strings to other things, sort of events that can help you get there. And I know that sounds nebulous and weird, but it's really not that hard as long as you have the privilege of having enough money to make it to every event, which is like this enormous privilege that people don't take into account. Probably have the privilege of living in North America, because it's impossible for anybody in any other country to make it to all these events that you need to go to. And you've got friends who can do introductions, right? So all those three things might sound really simple, but they're nigh impossible for someone who lives, let's say, in South Africa, who can't make it to events, right? And so if you don't have those three things, then you need a lot of luck. You need someone who's willing to sort of send out these emails every day and like show their game in a way that, you know, isn't in person at an event, but maybe catch the attention of someone who's able to look at what you're making. And I think some systems, Sony's getting better. Sony's doing a lot more abroad. So they're doing stuff in a lot more in like Mexico and South America and that kind of thing, Brazil. More and more places are trying to reach out to Europe. They're not there yet, but they really need to do more of it. And I don't know, like I said, it's hard for me to determine right now what is luck and what was actually, you know, hard work, because they feel like the same thing in the moment.
Well, sometimes luck is just a combination of hard work and, you know, like if you are prepared and you understand that it would be really good for your game if you you think the game is probably good enough now that it could be on PS4, but you just don't have any connections there and you can't just email like ps4@sony.com and they're like, oh great, your game's on PS4 now. And so, you know, if you sort of recognize that and then also recognize that you should be sort of paying attention to that, you know, stream in your communications and your emails and the people you're talking to and the things that you're listening to, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you listen to a podcast and someone who's like newly been, graduated to the game curation team at Sony is giving an interview and they're like, oh yeah, like, you know, I'm really excited to find some new games, so email me or something. But like sort of having an ear out for that, that's luck, but it only triggers the sort of the luck effect if you're paying enough attention and that you sort of understand what your goal is immediately and you're sort of doing the legwork to
I mean, we can go on for hours talking about how impossible that is when you're trying to actually make a game, right? Paying attention to anything outside of the game when you're actually making the game is a huge undertaking. Like, it's really hard to do. And there's so much energy being devoted into actually making the thing you're trying to promote later that you forget about promoting it right now.
Yeah, and then it's done and oops.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also easy to feel like that process is kind of like a load of crap, like that it is something that's not, that's not fair and that doesn't really relate to what you're doing with games. I think it's easy to overlook that the curation that process does of just selecting the people who actually care enough to do it is an important part of keeping the quality up, right? Like that, yeah, it sucks that you have to go out and like shake people's hands and get to know people. But if there was just like email your game's binary to ps4@sony.com and it'll be up on the PS4 store, then you'd get the situation that you get with like iOS, where things are unpleasant in part because it's too easy to get things on there. And so there's mm-hmm. too much crap and it's difficult to find the stuff that isn't crap. And so just putting that extremely low bar of like needing to be willing to go and talk to people at parties is enough to take out like, half of the bottom portion of games. And yeah, there's going to be a few gems that get lost in that process. Like, there are going to be some people who could make a really great game but can't go through that process. And, that system kind of sucks for those people. But the reality is that most of the people that are passionate about this and are like, I have to succeed at this or my life isn't complete, are going to be willing to put that effort in. And so, it's worth it to put that filter on things that, that the people who don't really care and are just like meh and aren't willing to put the effort into, they're probably going to be making the crummier games. And in some sense, gamers are going to be better off without them because they have a limited amount of time to look at each individual one of these games and determine whether or not it's good. And so you need some filtration process. You need some curation.
Yeah, that's a problem in so many industries, both with content and people and all these sort of things, is that there'd be this perception of unfairness. Like, it's not fair that, you got a job at this company because you met someone who worked there. They should only be hiring based on, the resumes that they get in or something like that. But the people tend to overestimate how much the people who are making these decisions of like which games are going to have in PS4 or who do we want to work at this, at EA or whatever, are being made by people who have a practical limit on their time. And so for those people, they want the best results, whether or not they're hires or their games on the system or whatever. And they have a strictly limited amount of time. And so any function that they apply, like not having PS4 at Sony.com just be a way to upload random binaries, you know, anything that they decide that will cut out a percentage of stuff that, yeah, there'll be some false negatives, like maybe there are some good games that don't get promoted, is not nearly as bad to them as now I have more games than I could ever possibly look at all of them, and I just cannot filter through them all in any practical way. Like, that is a worse problem than there's some good game that I haven't found yet. And those people obviously always want to be finding more good games, and, you know, we say kind of semi simplifying, like, oh yeah, you have to meet someone at a party, but that's not actually true. Like, if you release a game and it is really popular through other means, like either it's promoted on Twitter or you're promoting it at booths, or you're just showing it at your local meetup, or it gets featured on a podcast or whatever, however people find it, and then suddenly it's tearing up the charts and it's getting good press, and then sort of it's snowballing that way, eventually you'll start getting contacted by people like, hey, do you want to bring your thing to this console, or hey, maybe this should be on Steam, eventually at a certain scale. So
yeah, and I'm working on a project right now that I won't name, but it's definitely exactly that. It was an old game that was popular on Flash sites, and now it's been picked up and asked to be something much bigger. This is like a project that was from several years ago. This isn't something that, like, you know, was sort of this year and suddenly it was picked up. It's like, no, it was a slow burn, but it was worth it, right? So yeah, totally.
So you worked on the sort of marketing production process for Towerfall, which is an interesting Vancouver success story. I think that that's a good example of where the sort of story of the game coming about really like kind of helps in the marketing. So for anyone who's not familiar, it was sort of Matt Thorson is here in Vancouver. He's living in a house of other indie game developers and sort of working on this game as a party game and demoing it and playing it with other indie developers, which is pretty much like the best kitchen you can have for a multiplayer, real-time sort of a fighting game. And then launched it on the Ouya, which was like a really weird decision, or seemed like a weird decision at the time, that ended up being super successful because it was by far the best game on the Ouya. And everyone was, you know, journalist who was writing about the Ouya, which was this sort of quirky, like, oh, well, there's this new console, I guess we should write about it, wants to write about the killer game. And so they write about Towerfall. How accidental was all that? That it's like kind of the story of the game development ends up being part of sort of what people think about when they're marketing and talking about the game.
I would venture a guess to say that it is completely accidental. I think that Indie House is this lovely little sort of innocent bystander in the fame that surrounds it. Like, it just doesn't, it's so lovely and so great. And it's just a bunch of guys, you know, and people in general working together and bouncing ideas off each other and having a great time. And that translates into something that we can all relate to. But especially in the case of Towerfall, you know, Matt wanted to make something, and I won't speak too much for him, but Matt wanted to make something that was really fun and wanted to play it with his friends, and then did. And I think that, again, Towerfall is one of those games and situations in which I wonder, it's so hard to look back and say, like, what was luck and what wasn't. The game is so good and so fun that everybody who plays it recognizes that. But did it get that way because of people who played it, or is it recognized as such because of people who played it, right? Like, which caused it? I think it's a combination of everything. And the whole Ouya thing, too, is really amazing because it was timing, you know, is everything. You know, Towerfall makes it onto the Ouya. Ouya struggled for a bit. Towerfall sold a bunch of Ouya units, and, you know, that's from the mouths of people who bought the units. And suddenly there was a story, right? There was this, like, this interest in what Towerfall was because it was, you know, I think a lot of people see it as what kept Ouya afloat. I don't think that's true, but I think it is definitely something that contributed to Ouya's success in the end, if we can go back to when Towerfall released on it. I don't know. I think so many games would have the same story as Towerfall if only they looked to humanize themselves in that way. I think a lot of other games have this team behind them, have this, like, group of friends behind it, and it's a good story and something that we can all relate to, and yet they just don't tell that story for whatever reason, whether it's a privacy thing or They just don't think of it. I think that Ouya is not unique in that. It's just it was the first to do it really, really well.
It's always interesting to me talking to journalists and like over time in when you're thinking about marketing and PR and stuff like that, a lot of what you're thinking about is like how like the, your goal is to make sales. And then the goal under that is normally to get journalists and people to write about and talk about and players to write about and talk about what you're making. And sort of the level under that, the way that you do that in general is to for them to, there to be a story for them to write about. Like, and in order for it to be a story, it has to be something that sounds relatively unique or unusual or just interesting that people can relate to. And so if the story is guy sat in basement and typed for 2 years and then game came out, then well, that's not a story because that's constantly happening around the world everywhere. And sometimes it seems like, because everyone does have, there's virtually every game, there is something interesting about its creation process, but it's not necessarily obvious to the person who's in the middle of it, because it was just like, yeah, I was just at home and making this game, and like Matt might have kind of felt like he was guy in basement making game at the time without necessarily then kind of zooming out to understand the context.
Exactly.
Because it was just life.
Well, and the sort of thing that happened with Towerfall and the Ouya isn't something you would plan even if you know about it.
No
like,
way.
Having
no
your marketing
way.
Plan be, I'm going to be the system seller for a failed console. Like,
yeah.
That's a terrible marketing
yeah,
plan.
Yeah, no, right? Like, yeah.
And it worked out really well for him in this case, but you it would be fairly reckless to plan on that in advance. Like, presumably he made it for the Ouya because he was like, hey, this looks really interesting. I think this is going to be big. And so he... You know, he put it on there for that reason, not because he was like, wow, this is going to be a terrible failure and I should be the best game on this system so I can pick up all the free publicity from it failing.
Yeah. Publicity stunts don't exist in indie games. You know, that doesn't happen. We don't have enough money to think about that kind of thing. And not only that, we don't have enough time or energy to think about that sort of thing. So anybody who thinks that publicity stunts actually exist in indie games are not in touch with the industry whatsoever.
And people have pretty good imaginations.
Very good. Very good.
Awesome. So how can people find more about what you're up to, Maya, and what you're working on?
So I'm going to be launching a site in the new year. And until then, all the updates are going to go over on my Patreon, which is just patreon.com/LEGOBUTS. But also you can follow me on Twitter for every update about every cat I stay with, because I stay with a lot of cats as I travel the world, over it at LEGOBUTS.
Excellent. So I'll put links to both of those in the show notes. Thanks to everybody for listening. We always want to know what you think. So give us some feedback. Either you can send us an email, hello@upup.fm, or you can give us a rating on the iTunes store. And see you next week.
You're talking about the PR disaster of the PSN being down for 4 days over the Christmas holidays.
You know, I just didn't, I sort of was taking an actual break, like a real break from games, which means I wasn't even playing them, right? And I kind of looked at Twitter every now and then and just saw people freaking, like I was searching on Twitter for those kids who didn't get iPhones and then were really angry about Christmas, because that's like one of my favorite things ever, is kids who are angry about not getting iPhones.
Not getting an $800 device.
Okay. Yeah, and instead I found all sorts of people just like irate that PSN was down. Like, I don't know, it was pretty funny to look at.
It's kind of a PR disaster, but really PR-wise, it's not that bad when both Xbox and PlayStation are down.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Then it's just sort of lame, right? Whereas if it was just Sony, which is sort of what we'd expect based on all the incompetence on Sony's online stuff
exactly.
recently, then it would have been like, oh, look at it. All the poor kids who got PlayStations can't play them, but everyone's playing Xbox right now.
Sony did stay down, right? Like, that's the main difference, is that both of them were down on Christmas while the actual denial of service was going on, but then Sony, it may be back up now. They claimed it came out back last night, but I could not actually log on last night yet.
Neither
I haven't tried this morning. But Xbox has been up for a couple days now. Like, I think it was back up on the 26th. So it's, I think, turning into a bit of a PR crisis for Sony. Maybe it's resolved. Like, I basically just rolled out of bed and came downstairs to record the podcast. So I don't know what the situation is this morning.
I definitely played Destiny yesterday, but I don't know if that actually
on PlayStation?
It. Yeah, on PSN.
I played, and also sometimes certain games have like a separate server, true, depending, and things like that. But supposedly it was caused by denial of service, so some hackers were like, "Huh, wouldn't it be funny if we ruined a bunch of kids' Christmas? That would be really funny for the lulz." And so they hacked, or hacked. And denial of service isn't really hacking.
It's not really hacking anyway,
banging on the server a lot, and the server gets sad. But the...
it's a great description.
It's basically
exactly what happens, yeah.
Yeah, but they put on like they show on the news, the hacker photo is always like someone wearing a balaclava, so you can't see him while he's typing on the keyboard.
So silly.
So they did that while, you know, a bunch of bots kind of banged on their servers. But I tried to play Dragon Age yesterday, which is not an online game in any way other than when you start your game, you can like import from the web. And I think there might be a multiplayer version, but I haven't tried it and I'm not very interested in it. And so just loading up the game, it just spins forever if the server is down. It just says connecting to Dragon Age server. And it doesn't do the sort of like... Normally, you time out after 60 seconds and would say, sorry, could not connect, but it will never do that. Like, I went, made coffee or got a beer or something like that, came back, it's just spinning forever. And apparently, the secret trick of how you can play the game is go and turn Wi-Fi off in the settings, and then it just can't find it. It's like, oh, I guess there's no network, so it will play. So I had to do that.
That's really good to know.
My tragedy is that because... So I got a PS4 for Christmas, and so I finally... stepped into the modern console age, and because the network is down, even though I got a lot of non-network games, so I haven't been able to play games, I haven't been able to download any patches, so I'm playing through Assassin's Creed Unity unpatched.
Oh no.
Like an animal.
who would wish that on anyone? Although from what I've heard, all of the glitches and stuff, like a lot of them are still there, even in the patch version.
Oh yeah, I've heard it, just they don't go away. I mean, they're keeping, it's a feature now.
Yeah.
It's definitely a little twitchy, but I haven't had any of the like serious, like I haven't had any of the missing faces. I haven't had any mission breaks or anything like that yet. Like mainly it's just been kind of, oh, there's the occasional slowdowns. Oh, there's the occasional like pop in and visual glitchiness. There's a couple of the missions that are like quirky, like that there's clearly something that didn't quite work right, but it's not necessarily a, oh, this mission is broken. It's more of a like, maybe they just didn't QA this mission enough and I did something that they weren't expecting. Like you always have a few of those missions in any open world game where it's like one, you know, one designer built it and then like one QA guy played through it once and was like, yeah, this seems fine to me, and then they sent it out. And there's just maybe a few more of those in Unity than in some other games.
Right.
I find this particularly bad in Assassin's Creed because there's no difficulty setting, or at least there never used to be. And so if I was getting frustrated with a level, instead of reducing the difficulty, I would have to like play dirty. Like, okay, what happens if I beat this guy down half of the way and then I like hide behind this bush or like drop on the other side of a wall or something? And then the game script is just like, oh, it thinks that I'm not in battle anymore. Well, that's kind of weird. Well, actually, I can't get back up that wall anymore. Well, that's kind of weird. How do I get out of this hole? Help. So that's happened to me a few times in Assassin's Creed games. Are there any games that you're sort of working on or with that you're excited about that you're allowed to talk about, Maya?
On or with that I'm allowed to talk about? That's a really good question. On a podcast.
I mean, I would feel like you would probably often be allowed to talk about them because your job is in some ways to talk about them, but it's all about the timing of like, okay, is there anything to talk about yet? Like, do we have a video? Is this like under embargo or all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, no, it's funny. Exactly. Like, it's weird. The difference between an NDA and sort of my job is one day, right? It's overnight.
Yeah.
So I'm working on some really cool stuff right now, a bunch of which I can't really talk about. But I'm excited for, you know, there's a game called Spider 2 that's coming out that I might be doing a little bit of work with. And they're the guys, they're called Tiger Style. They did Waking Mars.
Okay.
And Spider, which was a game on iOS. I'm really looking forward to Spider 2 because it's going to be a really cool, really involved, in-depth game. And you basically just play the spider that's like, you know, exploring a house and picking up bugs and eating them for points. And that sounds, that's the simple version, but there's all this like amazing lore underneath it, and you can explore the house. It's kind of like, it reminds me of old point and clicks where you could click on everything and get to know everything in the scene, or you could just play through the game and not pay attention to everything around you. You know, you could just go through the main storyline. I really like those types of games. So that one I'm super excited about.
Spyder, yeah. The original Spyder, I thought was kind of interesting in that way, in that it's kind of like a puzzle game and a point and click adventure, like layered on top of each other, where you can just choose not to play the point and click adventure if you
exactly
don't want to, right?
Like, I think that's
just
so cool.
Play it as kind of a strange little puzzle game of building these webs and catching these flies and not pay any attention to what is going on in the house, or you can like search all the areas and, you know, see all the little side things and try and work out like what all this stuff means. And yeah, it's hard to think of another game that's got that kind of behavior. Like, most puzzly sort of games are just kind of, you know, it's the puzzle and there's nothing else going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like the idea of that layer. So I'm excited about that. Otherwise, I'm playing a bunch of, you know, I don't play AAA games anymore, except for the past 2 months where I've been playing, I hate to say this, man, I am playing so much Destiny. It's a bad game. I understand that it's like objectively a bad game, but I love it and I can't stop playing it. And it's like they put something in it that's just made me addicted, and I think about it all the time. And and then Dragon Age, obviously. So
obviously, because yeah, everyone except Nigel is playing Dragon Age.
It's really good, Nigel. You should pick it up.
Yeah, if you have an extra like 100 to 200 hours of your life.
I do not have an extra 100 to 200 hours.
Destiny is, I mean, we've talked about it kind of on and off over time because it's a very common thing people bring up as a game that they're playing. And I felt the exact same thing. I'm like playing, I'm like, this is bad. This story is bad. Many things about this game are bad. I'm just going to keep on playing I don't know why I am, but they've obviously done a very good
it's
job.
It's the bloody leveling, right? It's the fact that I want to get to the point where I can raid. And I don't even know really what raiding is, but I want to get there so that I can know what it is, so that I know if it's good or not. And I have to be level 26, which takes like 70 hours. Anyway, it's stupid.
Yeah. A lot of people have said the raiding is particularly good. Like, it's a good part of the game, and that you get a lot of satisfaction about running around with a whole bunch of other people blowing up Crota, whatever that is, because I am not high enough level to do that, but
well, continue enabling me, please, by telling me that thing. So.
But Dragon Age, I mean, it's all different, you know, choose your poison for grinding, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all fun. I agree. I've been getting just into the sort of addiction, sort of high level of Dragon Age. I'm probably halfway through the game, although I say that like there's
an end.
Yeah, like it'll ever end, because there'll be areas like infamously in the sort of first area of the game, the Hinterlands, where it's like, oh, okay, like intro to the game, you can go and do quest, and there's like 50 quests just everywhere, and you can't complete a quest without finding 4 more quests.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. That's how they get you, and then you get distracted and you can't remember the first one you were doing, because it's not like you don't have like a log of the quests you were doing. You're just wandering, finishing them, right? So it's like, yeah, no, it's a nightmare when it comes to that kind of thing. The grind, or like how I know at the end of the game I will want to get every single like thing I can ride on, like every mount, and there's like 12 horses and like 4 dragons.
Yeah,
I don't even know how to unlock those.
Do you know if the dragon guys fly? Because like I see they have wings on when I preview them, but I'm like, oh, that seems too good to be true.
I know. Well, WoW did it, so maybe they'll do it.
Yeah, that's true.
And my sister killed her first dragon the other day, and it was amazing, like amazing. Right? There's nothing like the rush of killing a dragon. It reminds me of Skyrim in that way. So.
Yeah, well, but Skyrim had dragons everywhere, whereas this one, like, I don't know, maybe I'm doing it wrong, but I don't see dragons very often. It's called Dragon Age. You'd think that.
Well, when you see dragons, you run.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's kind of cool. That's realistic in a way, right?
Yeah, whereas in Skyrim, like, I kind of accidentally killed a dragon and, like,
yeah, me too.
I was level 3 or something. Yeah. And then it's like this giant dragon. I'm like, oh, no. Oh, he died.
No big deal. Yeah, no, get your butt handed to you in Dragon Age by dragons. So, and you see a baby and you're like, oh, it's so cute. And then you realize, wait, if there's a baby, and then a giant mother comes out of nowhere and you're like, oh, this is a good game. I like this game.
That's exactly what should happen.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of mobile, I'm just playing, like, I've downloaded the Monument Valley DLC, which I haven't played yet. and I'm nonstop playing Papers, Please on my iPad.
Oh, yeah. I got to get that now that that's out on the iPad.
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, I was a big fan of Papers, Please beforehand, but it's so good on iPad. It's so much fun. It's easy to, like, control, but it's still difficult. The difficulty level is still through the roof, obviously. And, yeah, it's really satisfying. It's really satisfying.
Yeah, I'm running over my head, like, the controls and, like, things like stamping passports and stuff like that, I feel like would be satisfying on the iPad.
Yeah, super good.
Did they end up unblocking? So Papers, Please, for anyone who hasn't played it, is this like sort of dystopian, dark. The art style is like kind of semi-monochromatic, flat and stuff like that, like, you know, stylized style. And one of the things that you have to do in the game, which is sort of intended to be uncomfortable or unpleasant, is do these like sort of nude x-ray scans of people to see whether or not they're smuggling things. And then on iOS, Apple sort of rejected them because of this like pixelated quote unquote nudity, even though it's not by any stretch of the imagination, it's supposed to like to be attractive. It's just sort of part of the fiction of the world. And then I read that they were going to allow him to bring it back and that it was like a quote-unquote misunderstanding, which basically means a junior app reviewer just followed the rule, but senior person is like, oh, bad PR, let's undo this. Do you know if that ended up coming through? Or
it's not through on mine yet. I would have assumed it would have auto-updated, but I can go check for a manual update. I did hear the same thing you did, that they're bringing it back. And it, you know, it's so funny because a lot of people got really... Twitter that day was kind of a shit show because it was this... a mix of people who were angry that it was being taken away and then other people saying like, why are you mad? It's just, you don't need like, you know, naked people in your game. Like it's just let them take it away. And then a lot of people just miss the fact that a lot of the narrative in Papers, Please is this dystopian thing where you let people through, even though there's a discrepancy in all of their, you know, identification. And one of those is gender.
Yeah.
And so if their gender, if they come up and like to the protagonist's point of view, their gender doesn't match. If they look, you know, masculine and their gender says feminine on their passport, then you have to check them. You have to put them through the system and like take a picture of them naked. And then you have this choice of like, do I let them through if they're trans or not, right? And it's like, it's actually really heart-wrenching. It's like really hard because you take this hit every time you let someone through and you shouldn't have and blah, blah, blah. And I found myself just saving up. Like I got so good at the game that I could just save up all my freebies, all, you know, my hits that didn't deduct out of my pay and let every trans person through because I just refused to not let them through. You know, it's just really hard for me to not let them through. So, yeah, I mean, and that's something that is taken away when you don't have it, the nudity. That's something that just sort of is erased, that controversial point is erased, and that's no good. Don't do that, Apple. Don't do that.
Those experiences, yeah, those sort of experiences are exactly what makes the game interesting, like forcing those choices and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then also the irony, and like I think this is part of why people got as loud about it, is that the game is about like oppressive censorship and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's, when you censor it, it kind of seems a little, it's like censoring 1984. Like, well, but, you know, we have this rule that says you can't have, you know, nudity or whatever. And it's like, it's 1984. I'm pretty sure you can't censor it.
Yeah.
It's just a thing.